to today's seminar. Today we'll be looking at reuse opportunities at CAP Superfund sites, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response in their Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation. My name is Jean Balance. I'll be serving as one of the session moderators for today's event. In just a moment, I'll turn things over to Melissa Friedland, who's coming to you from the same OSWER office. But before I do that, let me walk through a few basic reminder items for our participants. Today's entire session will be offered online through Adobe Connect. So you'll be able to sit back and watch in real time as our speakers deliver their sessions through a variety of locations across the U.S. today. For those of you that are new to our webinars, you should have a reminder email in your inbox that has all of the instructions you'll need for today's live broadcast. And that email will ultimately point you to a seminar homepage where you can download the slides, read more about today's broadcast, find contact information and bios for our instructors, even share your feedback after our session. To join us live, though, you'll click a button labeled Go to Seminar that appears in the upper left-hand corner. That'll check you in and it'll bring you on board to our Adobe Connect room. If you have problems joining us online through Adobe Connect, you can download the slides and simply dial in on the phones, but please know you will miss out on some interactive features, so we encourage you to try to join us online for the full session. By default, audio is available online through the entire broadcast, so you should be able to listen to this through your computer speakers or mobile device with a pair of headphones. If you have problems with the online audio, check your local volume configurations first. You might need to go into your sound control panel and increase your speaker output. If that doesn't solve the problem, we do have toll-free call-in information for anyone who needs it. Simply use the question box in the lower right to request a call-in number, and we'll be more than happy to get you on the phones. If you join us on the phones, all callers will be globally muted, and we ask that you remain globally muted to help minimize background noises and other audio disruptions. Again, the question box appears in the lower right corner of your screen in Adobe Connect, and that will remain open throughout the entire broadcast so that you can submit comments, questions, and to report technical problems. We will take designated breaks, and we will read through the questions that have been entered electronically into that box during these breaks so that our instructors can answer them. We'll try to get through as many as we can in the time allotted, but I do encourage participants to don't wait for those breaks. Type up your questions or comments as soon as they occur to you. Today's session is going to be recorded, and we will automatically email all participants as soon as we have a link available to replay today's broadcast. So just keep your eyes peeled. It usually takes us about 1 to 2 weeks to produce these archive sessions. And once you get that, feel free to forward it on. And of course, if you want to learn more about the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative, you'll find dozens of previously hosted webinars as part of our nearly 600 archived sessions listed on the page below. And just one more quick reminder, you can join us on the seminar from the seminar homepage by clicking the Go to Seminar button. And then, of course, when you join us online, you'll see a screen something like this. The slides will appear here on the left. If you're having problems viewing the slides, there's a button. It used to say full screen. Now it looks like four arrows pointing in opposite directions. If you click that button, it'll make the slides bigger. Click it a second time, it'll shrink them back down. For now, you'll want to pay attention to a Q&A window in the lower right corner that you can submit your comments and questions, as well as to report technical problems at any time. And then we do have another box that appears in the middle right that has links to other important resources. Simply click on the link of interest, press the Browse To button, and that'll open up those sites locally on your own computer. I think that's the end of the technical reminders that I have for today's session. So I'm going to go ahead and turn things over to our first speaker today, Melissa Friedland. Melissa?
Thank you, Jean, and good afternoon. It is afternoon here in Washington, D.C. My name is Melissa Friedland, and I'm the National Program Manager for Superfund Redevelopment. I want to thank you all for joining us today as we continue our year-long celebration of the 15th anniversary of the Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. And the initiative, or SRI as we call it, hosts these webinars as part of a quarterly series about the reuse of Superfund sites. Our webinars share the stories of sites and projects that are part of SRI, as well as provide guidance and tools to support the appropriate reuse and redevelopment of Superfund sites. Today, we're discussing reuse on capped Superfund sites. Next one. For today's webinar, I'll start with a very brief introduction to reuse and EPA Superfund Redevelopment Initiative. SRI plays a key role in supporting reuse as a priority at EPA, and I'd like to take a few moments to share the ways that we can support site reuse before I hand things over to our presenters, who'll dig into case study examples that exemplify what can be achieved when EPA works with site stakeholders and focuses on bringing capped Superfund sites into productive use. Dan Keefe, Chris Thomas, Fran Costanzi, and John Gorin will share with us their experiences at CAP sites and reuse across the country. These sites are all very different, and they bring with them a unique story of how reuse can be implemented at CAP sites. Our presenters will demonstrate that there's a wide range of reuse types that may be appropriate. We are excited to hear their stories, so why don't we get started? Feel free to ask questions of them. We'll try and answer questions after each session, but we may hold some of the questions if we think future presenters will address them. They'll also have time at the end for remaining questions. Okay, next slide. While EPA's primary mission is to protect human health and the environment, Superfund cleanups have also played an instrumental role in returning contaminated sites to productive use. SRI works with communities and other partners in considering future use opportunities and integrating appropriate reuse options into the cleanup process. This helps local communities realize that the productive reuse of their formerly contaminated properties can have a variety of significant positive economic, environmental, and social impacts. Communities have been reusing sites for many years, and SRI supports communities' efforts to return these sites to productive use. We work at a national level, working to develop policies, tools, and performance measures that help support reuse activities, and also at a regional level, supporting site-specific projects and sharing lessons learned. Next one. EPA has always been supportive of site reuse, but our thinking about the consideration of reuse in the remedial process has evolved. Right now, what we would say is that integrating reuse into the cleanup process helps in a number of ways. It informs cleanup decisions at a site to ensure a remedy matches the intended end use of the property. It protects remedies in the long term through stewardship and maintenance of the property and implementation of appropriate institutional controls. It opens the door for local economic revitalization by attracting businesses, jobs, and clientele to the area, and it provides important social benefits such as ecological and recreational resources and community gathering spaces. In addition, the reuse of contaminated properties can promote sustainable and livable communities by advancing smart growth development principles, and it can support the use of alternative energy resources as an important part of America's energy security and environmental sustainability. I think there's sometimes a misconception that redevelopment and reuse cannot happen at a site until the remedial action is completed. But I want to be clear that reuse considerations can and should be explored at any point during the Superfund cleanup process. So whether you're looking at reuse while developing remedial action objectives for the site, when selecting a remedy, or even during long-term operation and maintenance of the remedy, reuse can inform the cleanup process in a way that helps ensure the long-term protectiveness of the site. Okay, next page. When reuse is considered early in the cleanup process, a site is in a better position to apply the reuse tools provided by SRI for returning the site to productive use. We found that site reuse provides a variety of economic, environmental, and social benefits. For example, commercial reuse of sites can support new jobs, tax revenues, and added income. We have seen increased public revenue and property values at and around sites where reuse has taken place. With vested interest and long-term stewardship of the property, reuse also leads to better protection of human health and makes a site less likely to be a target for vandalism or illegal dumping. Sites may also provide recreational opportunities and restore valuable wetlands or natural habitats that would otherwise be unavailable. Next slide. In 1999, SRI provided 10 pilot grants to eligible governments, local governments, and between 1999 and 2002, the grant program expanded to include 70 communities who received program assistance. And based on lessons learned during those pilot projects, which I want to be clear we don't do anymore, the process to support reuse planning evolved into what we now call regional seeds. And regional seeds are resources that SRI provides to communities at the request of EPA regions. While they do not fund environmental assessments, cleanups, or actual site redevelopment, they do provide an initial investment to help communities get started thinking about reuse. Next. The tools and resources available through SRI are critical to supporting the agency's strategic plans and goals, and goals, including the Reuse Directive's mandate to explore reuse throughout the Superfund process. So this slide just highlights a few of the tools available. We have something called the Return to Use Initiative, which aims to remove barriers to reuse that are not necessary for the protection of human health, the environment, or the remedy at those sites where remedies are already in place. And we have something called the Ready for Reuse Determination, or RFRs, which provides a single summary document outlining that a site is ready for reuse. It documents that a contaminated site has been characterized and cleaned up to the extent necessary for specified current or future types of uses, as long as the use limitations identified continue to be met. Use of RFR determinations has proven to be valuable for dealing with confusion over what future uses are appropriate at a site and helpful in facilitating the public and private reuse of sites. SRI also uses something called Site-Wide Ready for Anticipated Use. It's a performance measure to report the Superfund program's accomplishments in making land ready for reuse at sites where construction of the remedy is complete. This measure reflects EPA's priority on reuse as an integral part of the agency's cleanup mission for the Superfund program. And next, please. Since creation of the Superfund program, remedies have been completed at thousands of sites across the nation, and in the 1990s, the agency began to notice that many cleaned-up sites had been left idle or abandoned. So just very quickly, in 1995, EPA issued the Land Use Directive, which emphasized the need to incorporate a community's desired future uses for the property into the remedy selection process. And in 1999, the agency launched SRI, to help communities return their sites to safe and productive use. And since 1999, we've worked with communities to develop guidance and tools, share lessons learned and reuse success stories, and provide training and guidance. And most recently in 2010, EPA released the Reuse Directive, which addresses considering reuse throughout the cleanup process. And this guidance helps EPA regions consider site reuse in all stages of the Superfund pipeline and presents factors to consider when pursuing a change to a remedy. This year, 2014, is the 15th anniversary of SRI, and reuse has made great strides. Currently, we're aware of over 730 sites supporting actual, continued, or planned reuse activities. Next. For those of you wondering where to begin when thinking about reuse, there are many different ways to reuse Superfund sites, and there is no one-size-fits-all solution to determining which reuse type will be most appropriate or how to make sure that the site is best reused. So this slide just represents the general categories that we use when looking at reuse. And the next one. So our webinar today is going to touch on a couple of the reuse types mentioned in the previous slide. However, with the right circumstances, all of these reuse types could be considered for CAP sites. So that being said, let's talk just a little bit about what it means to be a CAP site. Capping involves placing a cover over contaminated materials such as landfill waste or contaminated soil. CAPs do not destroy or remove contaminants, but they can perform functions to keep contaminants in place. They can be designed to reduce the amount of rainwater or snowmelt seeping through contaminated material below, which could carry contaminants to the groundwater. They can prevent erosion, prevent the wind from spreading contamination. They can prevent stormwater runoff from distributing contaminated materials and even control the release of harmful gases. The CAP design selected for a site will depend on several factors, including the types and concentrations of contaminants present, the size of the site, the amount of rainfall the area receives, and the future use of the property. Construction of a CAP can be as simple as placing a single layer of a material over lightly contaminated soil to placing several layers of different materials to isolate more highly contaminated waste. Some examples of types of CAPs are an asphalt or concrete cover, a vegetative cover with plants and soil, a drainage layer, which is usually composed of sand and gravel and which may contain slotted pipes, a geomembrane cover or strong plastic-like material, and finally, compacted clay is another common type of site cap. As I mentioned, sites can use just one of these or several depending upon what's required by the remedy. Next. I want to give you a few examples other than the ones that we're going to touch on today. And the Landia Chemical Company in Lakeland, Florida is an example of ecological reuse and green remediation techniques at a CAP site. And basically, EPA and the Florida Department of Environmental Protection worked with the potentially responsible parties to develop the CAP portion of the remedy so that it can incorporate native vegetation and ecological revitalization. The parties placed a CAP made of clay and native vegetation on top of clean fill to reduce stormwater infiltration. The vegetative cover offers the dual benefits of aiding remediation work and revitalizing the site's natural ecology. The trees help with groundwater cleanup efforts through uptake and phytoremediation, and today the cover is home to 1,000 individual trees and plants and provides habitats for native wildlife, migratory birds, and pollinators. And in addition to continued ecological use, there's a wholesale fertilizer merchant, which is operating a fertilizer blending facility. And last year, EPA chose the site for an Excellence in Site Reuse Award to recognize ecological revitalization and reuse activities at the site. The Butterworth No. 2 Landfill Superfund site is located in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's 120 acres along the Grand River. And in 2002, the City of Grand Rapids began to discuss possible future uses for the site. So the City of Grand Rapids worked with EPA to develop a reuse plan that would ensure the protectiveness of the site's remedy and allow opportunities for multiple recreational uses, including sports fields, walking trails, biking trails, and a skate park. And in 2009, the city completed a small bike trail across the site, and EPA and the city have also worked together to allow access to the on-site road for a local marathon race. Currently, EPA is working with the city to assess the possibility of constructing a solar energy generation facility on part of the site. And I also want to talk briefly about the DuPage County Landfill. It's a 40-acre landfill, part of the Blackwell Forest Preserve. It's a Superfund site within the Blackwell Forest Preserve in Warrenville, Illinois. EPA placed the site on the NPL, and the cleanup plan included repairing and ensuring the integrity of the cap, installing an extraction system, treating and disposing of landfill leachate, installing additional landfill gas vents, and conducting long-term monitored natural attenuation of groundwater. Institutional controls restrict land and groundwater use at the site. The site functions as a recreation area featuring restored native prairie vegetation, picnic trails, an observation area, and snow tubing. Other recreational and educational activities include two lakes, an archery range, an urban stream research facility, and are also located within the larger Blackwell Forest. Next slide. The 72-acre Mosley Road Sanitary Landfill, the Superfund site, is located near Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, and it's operated as a landfill for municipal, industrial, and hazardous waste materials since 1971. So working with joint venture companies, Waste Management of Oklahoma is implementing a new gas-to-liquid fuel technology demonstration project on site. And the technology converts methane gas collected from the landfill's gas collection system into clean-burning diesel fuel and wax. The joint venture will pursue the development of multiple renewable energy projects using this innovative technology both in the U.S. and abroad. And earlier this year, EPA Region 6 recognized Waste Management of Oklahoma with their Green Ovations Award for their successful remedial efforts at the ceremony that allowed an innovative gas-to-liquid fuel technology to become a reality. So I hope this has given you some background about SRI, how EPA works to support appropriate and safe reuse, and an idea of the variety of reuse options that CAP Superfund sites can support. So now I'd like to hand it over to our case study presenters, who will present in greater detail about specific CAP sites in reuse. So Dan, you're next.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. Thanks, Jean, for putting this together. Can everybody hear me?
We can.
I'm not getting any feedback. Somebody can just confirm you can hear me.
Dan, we can hear you.
Okay. Thank you for attending the webinar. My name is Dan Keefe, and I am an RPM in Region 1. Region 1 is the New England states, the six New England states, and more specifically, I am a RPM in the Massachusetts Superfund section. I've been an RPM since about 2007, and prior to that I worked at the state DEP. And here today to talk a little bit about the Norwoods PCB site. And this is a story of a sometimes long and tortuous, arduous cleanup and redevelopment. And I'd also add that a lot of the considerations of redevelopment kind of predate, at least in my opinion, a lot of the more recent emphasis put on reuse. And so it's good to see the added tools that are available today that probably didn't exist or were not as widely known in the late 1990s when we were considering some of the redevelopment possibilities at Norwood. So just I'm going to go through the background relatively quickly out of the interest of time to get to some of the better parts of the discussion. Norwood is a suburb of Boston. It's about 15 miles due west of Boston. The property is 10 acres in size. It's basically roughly this white area surrounded by a gray area. This is a relatively heavily traveled highway, or a commercial highway, two or three lanes each way, known locally as the Auto Mile, so it has dozens of car dealerships. In other words, this is a very commercial area. And the site was proposed to the MPL in 1984. It was added to the final MPL list in 86. And based on what we were able to accomplish, and I'll talk a little bit about this in detail moving forward, the site was deleted in 2011. So the operational history here, it was used since 1942. A number of operators were located on the site. Some very significant large contributors of the contamination. We did end up settling and negotiating seven consent decrees with seven past owners or operators. The primary contaminants are PCBs, but there's secondarily there's some VOCs and PAHs, trichlorobenzenes. And as I note here, the 24,000 parts per million PCBs in soil, that's just incredibly high. And so basically we've got soil that was primarily contaminated, and then due to runoff we had sediment that was contaminated, and there's a groundwater component as well. So as I mentioned, the site was added to the MPL in 86. By 1989 there was a ROD signed, and that ROD was further amended in 96, and the original remedy called for solvent extraction, and that was replaced or modified to a capping in place remedy. And that was, and not to get too on a sidetrack, but due largely to vendor limitations and vendor price structures that made solvent extraction in reality not consistent with what was considered during the FS and remedy selection process. Some of our larger PRPs with whom we ordered to conduct remedial activities, they contested the degree to which they contributed the VOC component. And based on negotiations that took place prior to my involvement, we basically had a PRP lead component, which was the capping, and a fund lead component, which was the treatment of groundwater for VOCs. So in 1996, the groundwater treatment plant was constructed. Again, as I just mentioned, that was fund lead. That was an EPA fund lead component, and the PRPs, through their contractor, began cap construction in 1997, and basically it took 2 years to build the cap that we'll be talking momentarily about. The groundwater treatment plant did operate for a period of 4 years, which doesn't seem that particularly long. I'd note that at the time of the ROD amendment, the groundwater cleanup goals were MCLs, and so those were pretty lofty goals, especially for an area, as I pointed out, as industrialized and commercialized as Route 1 in Norwood, that Auto Mile area. So in 2001, the state, and I don't know if this is something that's common amongst other regions or other states, but they submitted a groundwater use and value determination. And so if that's something that everybody's familiar with, I apologize for any extra explanation I might give, but that's something that we routinely ask for, at least in Massachusetts, and the state of Massachusetts would let us, they basically look at the resources around a site, they look at the availability of water, and the degree to which the aquifer underlying the site is a potentially productive aquifer. And, you know, based on all different factors, they submitted a low use and value, meaning that they did not consider the area groundwater a source of drinking water. And so, in effect, there was no need to treat groundwater to MCLs, and we revised our groundwater cleanup goals in a 2005 explanation of significant difference. So post-CAP construction, so fast forward here, this map is a relatively good depiction of the site in circa 2000, 2001. What I'm noting here is the different areas of the site corresponding to different levels of restrictions, and those are relative to different CAP components. And so just to take you through the green areas, Area A, these two areas are referred to as non-CAP, non-cover, and those are the least levels of PCB contamination. And then we have got Area B. I'm sorry, this label is off a bit, but Area B is this orange color here and here. These are referred to as cover areas and consisted of 12 to 24 inches of just gravel cover. Area C, highlighted in blue, and Area D, which is this strange yellow wedge, that is our cap area. Area C is referred to as the cap, and Area D is the slab cap. The difference being the performance standard is 12 inches of asphalt, and part of our thickness in this yellow area is attained by the building slab, the former Grant Gear Norwood PCB building slab. So this is all, for all intents and purposes, the blue and the yellow is the capped area under which our highest concentrations of PCBs exist. And again, this is, as I mentioned earlier, groundwater treatment plant was built and constructed and operated, and that's, you can see in this engineered drawing, it's located right here. It's and operated until 2001. So just, again, reviewing the different areas on site, we've got areas A, B, C, D, and E. There is one other area. It's not labeled, but this little section right here was a sub-slab cellar space into which a lot of extremely contaminated material was placed. That is referred to as the debris vault. And I note here that with each of these areas, and I think I'll spend a little bit of time talking about institutional controls, permitted uses, and land use restrictions. And with each one of these areas, we have got increasingly more restrictive controls, or ICs, that are applied to each of these areas. So we get to the good part here, reuse opportunities and reuse it at Norwood PCBs. And I've got a kind of a half-hearted question here. What is often needed to realize the redevelopment of a Superfund site? And you need an interested third party. You need somebody to realize, you know, their dream to be a business owner or to utilize a property to a higher level than, say, a vacant field or just an asphalt cap. So in our situation, we were, EPA was approached by a local businessman, and he purchased the property. And as depicted in the photo, he was and remains a used car salesman, and that's very consistent with the other property uses up and down the Route 1. As I said, it's the auto mile, and it's really, anyone who's familiar with Route 1 in Norwood knows that it's where a good part of the state goes to for their vehicles. So he did get a PPA, and for those of you not familiar, PPA is a prospective purchaser agreement. And this predates a lot of the brownfields protections that are now, I believe, by statute with some of the brownfield legislative changes. And this basically protected him from any liability for the cleanup. And it gave us a vehicle to require that he do certain things as well. And that's a large part of what I'm going to talk about. So the PPA required, among other things, that he provided the town with an electric vehicle, which he did. This is well before all the Priuses you see on the highways now. Again, this dates to 1999. He also was committed to, and at the time he was thinking he would reuse the groundwater treatment plant structure. The shell of the treatment building, provided we got rid of or reuse at other sites or disposed of the groundwater treatment plant equipment. And it also required that he record land use controls. As the property owner, you need the owner themselves to record the restrictions on the deed against their property. So those are all things to which he agreed. So as I mentioned, he was going to use the property as an auto auction and the shell of the groundwater treatment plant possibly as a car wash. However, based on our determination, the groundwater treatment plant was no longer necessary. I think that probably occurred faster than anyone might have realized when it was constructed. He thought the property could be used at a higher level than a auto auction and a car wash. And some of this I'm connecting because I'm not privy to all the conversations that took place. But he ended up leasing the property to a company I'll just refer to as Developer A. And Developer A basically signed a 99-year ground lease with the owner, and they had wanted to construct a big box store such as a Lowe's, Home Depot, or large Staples. In that reuse, we were supportive, I would say, of any reuse, and but we were not in a position to dictate to the town exactly the specifics of the reuse. And the number of meetings ensued at the local and town level about their plans and desire to create a put a big box store there. And as I note here, they were denied the local permit, and really it was on the grounds that all the abutters were concerned about a big box store breaching the cap, potentially exposing them unnecessarily to PCBs that were safely contained under the cap. I have a suspicion that their concerns were just as great about the lighting, the dust, the truck deliveries, all that are associated with a type of operation of a big box store, big box retail store. So they were not allowed, you know, they couldn't go forward with their original plans. And then in the interim, a different developer company acquired Developer A, which had the rights on the property. And when you acquire another company, you get, you know, both sides of their balance sheet, their assets and liabilities. And so Developer B basically had the 99-year ground lease. And we had negotiations and discussions with the town of Norwood as to what could be done. And their level of concern was greatly mitigated by not breaching the cap and leaving the existing capped area. Recalling that older slide that I mentioned, it was the blue and the yellow areas, the central part of the site, leaving that untouched and therefore kind of developing around that cap and using that cap as a central parking feature for any new redevelopment. And so that's where Developer B was quote-unquote forced to work around the cap. In so much it wasn't the original plan for redevelopment. So some of the challenges to make this happen, and I've touched on a few of them. In 2007, you know, we had, ever since the signing of the prospective purchaser agreement with Joe Lamb, had drafted a grant of environmental restriction and easement. And those are basically the ICs that get recorded against the property deed. So he had a requirement to record those, and we had the ability to kind of tailor those institutional controls, those permitted uses, and those restricted activities, and kind of contemplate some of the activities that they might want to have in order to redevelop the site. I guess just to jump back here, I mean, for anybody that, I don't know about nationally the status of institutional controls, it seems like it's frequently mentioned in remedies and rods, like, you know, thou shalt do X, Y, and Z, O, and ICs. And you read that and ICs quite a bit, because it's easy to put into a remedy because there may be some sort of limited use or restrictions. But it's really the devil's in the details when you're talking about ICs. There's a lot of work that goes into recording institutional controls, at least in Massachusetts and in Region 1. And these things really were satisfied more by the developer than the property owner. And so they updated title. There were a number of surveys that were required, both a surveyed plan of land showing all the various plots and parcels, but also a plan of land showing the various meets and bounds of the restrictions overlaid on the various plots. There were a number of encumbrances, and an encumbrance is a previous legal agreement or restriction. For example, there may be a sewer easement, or there may be other sorts of easements that cut through the land. And what we require and the state requires is that those encumbrances be subordinated to the grant of environmental restriction and easement, meaning that they acknowledge, even though it was recorded after their instrument, that they would abide by the restrictions. And so basically they subordinated their interest to our interest. And some of those encumbrances cost, you know, I didn't put it on the slide, but a number of those encumbrances, you know, cost the developer real money to obtain in the form of compensation for different entities to subordinate their interests. They also provided title insurance. And so that's just, you know, for it's worthwhile to keep in mind that, you know, ICs, institutional controls, there's a lot to them to be properly developed and recorded. And so as we were hashing out the finer details of the institutional controls in the grant, we were able to share drafts with the owner, whom shared them with the developer, and we added provisions for them to, say, work under a pre-approved work plan, which would allow them to move up to 25 cubic yards of soil in certain areas without coming in for approval every time they wanted to put in a fuel oil tank or move some soil to make a loading dock. And so it was pretty innovative in that way, and we worked hand-in-hand to get that grant in condition to be recorded. And so the grant, the institutional control, i.e. the grant, was recorded on this date in 2008. And on that very same date, we had been in receipt of the redevelopment work plan, which was a requirement of the grant. And they were able to prepare that work plan because they had seen and had opined on portions of the grant prior to it being recorded. So I just note that, you know, these things happen pretty seamlessly, and this was recorded on the same date that we were able to approve their work plan for redevelopment. So here's some pictures of during construction, and this is early in the construction, just some of the concrete block are going up. I note that this well, we have a number of monitoring wells that we preserved for five-year review reporting and for annual monitoring. A number of them, two of them had to be relocated outside of the building footprint, and this is one of the relocated wells. This is one of the two buildings just with the gravel subbase into which there is horizontal piping used for a passive vapor mitigation system. And this over here is, what's the product name? It's a liquid boot, and it's a membrane, spray-applied membrane over the gravel, which basically acts as a vapor barrier. We had required a vapor barrier in a passive system only because it's just a smart thing to do relative to VI, and it's very inexpensive to include in new construction. And we did have some VOC components in groundwater. And it was, like I said, it was a very easy thing to require in the grant of any new construction. And despite model projections that it wasn't necessary for a commercial industrial worker or an occasional site visitor, that is in place. And I've got additional pictures of that.
So Dan, again, just here's a quick time check. Dan, we had about a minute left for your portion of the talk.
Here is the membrane. And here is the horizontal piping coming up from beneath the slab, and it all comes together. I could have included a picture. It comes together and exits the ceiling on top where there's a one of those fans that rotates in the wind and helps just passively evacuate the subslab area. We did do some testing, and it didn't require any activation or the addition of a blower or a vacuum on that system, but we could do that if it was necessary. So also as part of redevelopment, they needed to raise the level of the cap, the remedial cap, if you will. So our cap, or the cap built by the PRPs to contain PCBs, is where the arrow is presently. And to make the site grading work, they added this visual demarcation layer, this orange snow fencing, then they added more gravel, and then on top of the gravel, they added their own surface coat of asphalt. And here's the redevelopment a little bit further along. This is one building, and the second building is to the right there. So post-construction, I should have put a date here, but Developer B, who you may recall, acquired the rights to develop from Developer A. They completed construction. They facilitated our recording of the grant. They did everything asked of them of the town, and they basically tried to lease their two buildings for the better part of a year, and they were not getting really any interest. And this time frame coincides with like 2010, 2011, when we were starting to feel the effects of the most recent recession. So they basically walked away, and they broke their lease with the owner. And this is and so the owner benefited by roughly $2 million spent on redevelopment, and that includes the buildings, but also infrastructure, and there were improvements to Route 1, new traffic lights, a widening of cross streets. And there was a significant amount of improvement made by Developer B. The owner himself began to market the property, and not having the same cost to recover, I'm sure that his point of departure or his he probably didn't need to make the same to make the project work because he didn't have any outlay to build the buildings, etc. Coupled with the fact that the economy was rebounding, in his attempt to find somebody to lease to, he actually found somebody that was interested in purchasing the property. And so he did sell off about two-thirds or 6 acres of that 10 acres, and so it was subdivided, and he sold the buildings and the property to a sports retailer in 2011. So here it is post-construction. Again, here are two buildings, and here is our cap and the slab cap. Again, it's not in pink and yellow as before, but you can see these areas. The non-cap, non-cover areas exist, and they basically are underneath this building and over here. The part of the site the owner retained is where the cursor is now, and there is tentative plans for two restaurants on that parcel. Those plans are not new. They were part of the original proposal to the town back in 2008, 2009. I don't know if things have turned around such that there's really any movement towards realizing that, but you know, all this land now is owned by the sports retailer. They occupy this store here, and this store they are looking to lease, and I believe they recently have a lessee and are doing build out for a workout world, so this will be a gym. This whole area is used basically as the central area for parking to support both of these businesses. And so here's some of the more recent shots. There's the sports retailer. If you zoom in on it, you can see the name. It's they do a combined brick and mortar retail business with a fairly significant warehouse business. This is the back of the same store. You can't see it very well here, but there's a mural because this the back of the store fronts Route 1. The town of Norwood early in the process required a mural be painted to make the building more attractive visually. And this is a building that we didn't talk much about. The original site acreage was 26 acres. There were a few outlying areas of PCBs that were brought back on what I've been referring to as the site and placed under the cap. There was no other residual contamination in those other areas. But those other areas did realize some additional redevelopment. So just to touch on a couple things, and hopefully I'm doing okay for time. As I mentioned earlier, ICs, they really are, at least for Region 1, can take a lot of time and a lot of resources, both legal resources, technical resources, and it's a lot of back and forth, particularly for commercial properties, which may have a number of other encumbrances. We did have the opportunity to tweak our grant to give the developers some more flexibility, and that has been further tweaked because they requested a slightly larger volume to be able to manipulate under a pre-approved work plan and we agreed with that. Again, the developer really stepped up and met a lot of the owner obligations to make the ICs a reality, the grant a reality. And the owner, for his part, he was motivated because he had a developer whom he had leased the land to. So it really, I don't know that we would have gotten him to move despite having a PPA with him, which required him to do so. He was much more apt to be cooperative in light of the pending redevelopment. And something I could and can spend some time talking about is trying to keep the harmony between the PRPs who built the remedial cap and the redeveloper. And there are things that come up from time to time that the PRPs feel maybe prematurely needing to be replaced as a result of redevelopment. And something we could all talk about is to what extent, if any, do PRPs bear any additional cost to realize redevelopment. And so they are very very particular, very specific, and we've included things such as the developer must, you know, sweep up any sand applied twice per year after the winter season in the spring and then again in the fall. There's a specific type of road salt that they can use. This is all so as to not cause the cap premature wear and tear. And so it's a little bit of a balance for me and for my state project manager, because we do have responsible parties out there that have an O&M requirement to maintain the portion of the remedy that they built. But by and large, it's worked out pretty well. So that's all I have. I don't know, Jean, do I throw it back to you?
Yeah, Dan. Yeah, can you hear us okay, Dan? Dan, can you hear us on the phone? Okay, I think in the interest of time, we do have some questions for, yeah, we're here, Dan. Can you hear us?
Oh, yep, I can hear you now. Did you hear me okay?
Yeah, we could hear you fine. We're running a little short on time, so I think Melissa has just one question for you now, and we'll hold the other questions till the end of today's session.
Sure.
Okay, Dan, so somebody's asked, why 12 inches of asphalt? That seems very thick.
Okay, as I think about it, it may have been, and I can verify that, it may be 6 inches of asphalt on top of 6 inches of gravel. If it is in fact 6 inches of asphalt, there were two courses of 3 inches each. And so that, I think I need to double check this. It's either two courses of 6-inch asphalt, but I'm thinking now that it's a 6-inch asphalt cap overlying 6 inches of gravel in the capped area. And that they couldn't get the full 6 inches of asphalt over a portion of the slab, so we took credit, quote unquote, for part of the slab thickness in meeting the performance standards of the cap.
Okay, great. Thank you. So I think, Dan, we're going to move on to our next speaker, but we'll try to turn back to your questions at the end here today.
Sure.
Great. Okay, so now I'd like to introduce Chris Thomas from Region 3, who's going to talk about Ohio River Park. So Chris, take it away.
Thanks, Melissa. I'll just wait for the screen to show here a second. And there it is. We're ready to go. As Melissa said, I'm Chris Thomas. I'm the Superfund Redevelopment Coordinator for Region 3. You've heard Melissa and Dan emphasize really how important reuse and revitalization are in CAP Superfund sites. It's a great opportunity for redevelopment. At Region 3, we've worked with community stakeholders to bring safe, productive reuse to our CAP sites whenever possible. Reuse opportunities on CAP sites can arise anytime during the cleanup process. It's important to be on the lookout for ways to bring reuse considerations to the table as early in the remedial process as possible. Hopefully this presentation will drive that point home. The story I'd like to share is from Region 3. We are the Middle Atlantic states. At a CAP Superfund site, Neville Island, Pennsylvania, where an early consideration of future uses was pivotal to the site's successful reuse. These reuse considerations at this site, the Ohio River Park Superfund site, helped inform the remedial design choices that benefited both the community and the cleanup in the long term. Can I get the slide to move here? Here we go. Let's give you a brief site location history. This site's been around a while. Seeing the slide, was placed on the National Priorities List in 1990. So a lot of this is pre-changing the liability schemes, but a lot of it is after SRI has come into being. So it's kind of a combination of the old and the new, and it's I think the story's it's a pretty good story to tell. Before going into specifics, I want to give just a brief overview of the site's history and basic background. 32-acre Ohio River Park Superfund site is located on the western end of Neville Island, Pennsylvania. Neville Island is an island. It's its own township. An estimated 1,200 people live on the island. The island is about 10 miles upstream from Pittsburgh on the Ohio River. The land used on Neville Island is primarily commercial and industrial, but there are some residences on the east side of the island. If you see the look at the slide there, the west end is to the left, the east end will be to your right. And there are some homes on the east end of that island. The site history follows the pattern of many of our Superfund sites. The 1930s until the 1950s, the site was a municipal waste landfill, accepting all kinds of waste. Back in those days, municipal landfills also contained hazardous waste, as we know. From 1952 to 1970, the Pittsburgh Coke and Chemical Company used the site as a dumping ground for its industrial waste. Again, that's a coking operation, so we know that there's very nasty contaminants that we had to deal with. The company dug trenches at the site to dispose of coking sludges, cement production waste, and pesticides. Slugging various solid demolition materials were disposed of at the west end of the island. These operations led to site-wide contamination of soil, surface water on the island, and the groundwater. Discovery of these conditions came in 1978. It's kind of a tragic story in a way. Allegheny County began construction for a park, then uncovered the industrial waste. They performed a study. The site was first proposed for inclusion on the NPL in October 89, and then finalized on August 30, 1990. During a remedial investigation, EPA identified three main soil areas that were heavily contaminated by coal tars, pesticides, organic chemicals, and heavy metals. Additionally, the coal tars were slowly migrating and a contaminated groundwater plume existed beneath the site. Throughout the Superfund process, EPA has actively worked with Neville Township, the state, and the Neville Land Company, the main PRP, to allow general infrastructure improvements and recreational reuse opportunities to advance alongside cleanup actions and remediation work. Back to the site history a little bit. Even before the discovery of site-wide contamination, the Neville Land Company owner at the time, Allegheny County, were interested in developing recreational facilities at the site. After discovering the contamination, Allegheny County ceased park construction and conducted a health study. This study identified various industrial domestic waste materials, including that human health hazard existed. As a result, the planned park never opened to the public. It was my understanding that it was mostly complete and the park was dismantled. The Neville Land Company reacquired the property and reimbursed Allegheny County for the park construction costs. Based on these earlier efforts, the Neville Land Company continued pursuing redevelopment plans of the site for recreational sports complex. Plans for a sports complex include an Olympic-sized ice rink facility, ice skating and hockey, golf driving ranges, fields for soccer and lacrosse, fitness center and restaurant, and necessary parking lots and sidewalks to accompany the complex. So the site owner saw the potential for redevelopment very early on in this process, as did Allegheny County. They had hoped to make the west end of this island a park. In addition to the sports center, the township expressed intense interest in the state during a remedial investigation stage in constructing a bridge on a portion of the site that would connect the island to nearby town of Curiopolis. And I apologize to those in western Pennsylvania if I just butchered that name. I believe it's might be Curiopolis, I'm not sure. But what happened was there's a 100-year-old bridge that linked Neville Island to the city. It was in such bad shape that there were severe weight restrictions and even time restrictions and when the bridge could be used. So it's kind of a compelling story that we can tell about how the bridge construction fitted into reuse as well. By identifying these reuse considerations early on in the process, EBA was able to pursue remedial alternatives and plans that would work favorably alongside all the various remedial components, even a cap and all the potential reuse plans for the site. Importantly, EPA created a separate operable unit for the bridge construction area in order to expedite the baseline risk assessment. Looking at the site areas that will be incorporated into the bridge construction project, EPA determined that these areas contain no soil contamination at hazardous levels. EPA then issued a no-action rod for this one-acre area of the site next to the Ohio River that enabled the township to construct the portion of the bridge on that portion of the site without waiting for your ongoing Superfund cleanup to pursue at other areas of the site. So right out of the gate, the importance of getting that bridge built was very important, and EPA did break out the one-acre portion of the site. The risk assessment was done, no soil contamination at hazardous levels, and a no-action rod was issued for that portion, which allowed the bridge to be constructed. Construction, I think, began in 89, and it took 2 or 3 years for the bridge to be done. But that's number one success story there. Let me change the slide here. To allow for the construction will later be called the Island Sports Center, EPA chose remedial design alternatives to allow for surface redevelopment while simultaneously furthering soil and groundwater remediation. This island is located in a 100-year floodplain. I'm sure that's probably changed to the 50, 75-year floodplain now. Historically, the water level had been known to rise above the level where waste were located. Obviously, the island was flooding out at various moments. To stop further migration of these waste and coal tar, an impermeable cement slurry wall was constructed along the slopes in impacted areas. And I'm going to, there it is right there. Thank you very much, Gene, for moving that back. There's the construction of the slurry wall. You can see that there. And this is important because what happened was, rather than excavating and moving the soil, which might inhibit or further delay any construction on the surface, EPA approved the remedial design plan that included construction of a multi-layer cap covered by clean fill material and vegetation. Out of this 32-acre site, approximately 11 acres of this was where the gross soil contamination occurred. That's where the multi-layer cap was placed. Drainage layer in the cap composed of non-woven geotextiles ensured proper drainage to collection pipes that prevented stormwater infiltration. Prior to construction of the recreational complex, the site owner performed studies to verify that the planned site structures would not disturb the capped areas. Sediment plate covered with 5 or more feet of clean soil were placed over areas where surface structures would be built. Potential sediment was monitored for up to 3 months, and the results verified that the weight of the planned surface structures would not disturb the cap. The site was regraded to make it completely level for redevelopments, which required placing another 3 to 8 feet of clean soil, that's more than what was actually required for the environmental remedy, over the multi-layer cap. The site owner installed sediment plates and regraded portions of the site with 3 to 8 feet of clean soils and fill materials to elevate it above the 100-year floodplain. Placing multiple feet of this clean fill also ensured there would be enough space to install new utility or sewer lines associated with the recreational facilities without disturbing the cap. And this is very important. We have a few sites now where we're discussing how thick the clean fill layer should be to promote future land use where you might have to put in some sewer lines, water lines, electrical lines. So that was very important in this process that there be enough space to install those lines. The parking area is asphalt. The athletic field area includes a drainage layer to accommodate the potential for precipitation. This drainage layer directs water to collection pipes and then to the municipal sewer system. Let's see, I'm going to move the slide here. There we go. Gene, you're the best. The facilities on the 7-acre, actually it's 11-acre multi-layer cap include the athletic field now, you see in the pictures there, track and field areas, bleachers, and the golf dome. It's an indoor golf facility. It's kind of interesting. The baseball teams practice in there as well as softball teams during the early spring weather that we get here, which is, as we know, usually not very good for sports teams in the spring. The plans for the golf dome facility called for cement foundations, and it was concerned that the sheer weight of these foundations could potentially disturb the soil covering cap. Approximately 12 feet of additional clean fill was added over the large capped area to make sure the cap could sustain the weight of the surface redevelopment. For example, the building footers for the golf dome are placed 2.5 feet deep and 10 to 12 feet long. The design for the building footers was modified to be wider and shallower than they would typically be used to ensure that weight would be distributed evenly and to keep the footers in a clean fill area above the cap. EPA also decided to choose cleanup techniques for a remedial design that would ensure the site's continued remediation while allowing for the reuse construction. This included a passive gas collection system incorporated into the soil cover. You see the gas vent in that picture above on the left. Gas vents are placed on the opposite side of the fence outside of the running track to ensure they are unobstructed. This is an example of how EPA worked with the site developer to allow for reuse while maintaining the protectiveness of the remedial component. So just think about this. We had to raise this entire redevelopment area above the floodplain. So there's a lot of fill here. EPA determined that the groundwater plume had stabilized, then called for long-term monitored natural attenuation in the 1998 operable unit 3 rod addressing site groundwaters, three OUs at this site, by the way. To further prevent potential exposure to contaminated groundwater and to protect the site's remedy, institutional controls prohibit drilling and use of groundwater at the site. There was groundwater contamination, as I mentioned earlier, but the residents do not get their drinking water from those wells. They get them from the city wells across the river. Any water used in the facilities or for irrigation comes directly from the municipal water supply. Furthermore, to ensure continued protection of the Ohio River, Neville Land Company stabilized slopes along the back channel. This involved placing 1,400 tons of large riprap along shorelines to stabilize the riverbanks and prevent erosion. Importantly, the site does not contribute contamination to the Ohio River. Baseline risk assessment did find cancer risk from fish consumption. So EPA instituted institutional controls to prohibit fish consumption at the site. Rather than building physical barriers along the riverbanks, the PRP installed access control signs that deter visitors from fishing and consuming fish. It was found that the contamination, I believe it was mercury in the Ohio River at that point, was the same upstream as it was downstream. The site was determined not to be contributing to that contamination, but it was prudent to put up the signs anyway and deter people from fishing and consuming the fish. Okay. Following completion of the cap and remedial components, and this happened in 1999-2000, Neville Land Company constructed the Allen Sports Center. I'm going to go back here. One. There we go. There it is. And this is all part of the Allen Sports Center, which opened in 1999. Now, Robert Morris University purchased the property two allotments in 2003 and 2004. And they continue to operate the Island Sports Center to this day. The indoor ice rink is open 365 days a year. Open to the public, the rink is also the dedicated home facility for the university's men's and women's ice hockey teams. The rink is also used for skating, curling, and broom ball. The golf dome houses driving ranges and golf training facilities. Like I mentioned earlier, it's also used for early season softball and baseball training camps. The outdoor facilities continue to expand out here. There's a running track, a mini golf course, lacrosse field, and parking areas. 2005, Robert Morris University worked with EPA to ensure that construction of two additional sports fields would not disturb the remedy or its future protectiveness. As we mentioned before, the one-acre portion of the site includes the Neville Island end of the Coraopolis Bridge, which provides key infrastructure connections for traffic to and from the island. The latest five-year review was concluded for the site. It was concluded in March 2013, concluded that the remedy currently protects human health and the environment, and that the natural attenuation of contaminated groundwater is progressing as anticipated. Let's see. I wanted to go back to the key lessons here for a moment. Get the right slide here. Key lessons that we learned from this: consider alternatives such as phase cleanups, partial deletions, or no-action rod. The no-action rod that EPA issued for the one-acre portion to allow the bridge construction was crucial. It was critical that that bridge be built. So we're able to do that because the soil contamination levels were not alarming there. So that allowed us to do that. Combine a combination of remedial techniques when waste materials occupy a large area, such as multi-layered cap and slurry wall, rather than conducting intrusive soil excavation. Also, structures that are part of the remedial design can be integrated into the landscape, such as the vegetated soil cover, the passive gas fence, stabilized riverbank. Additional clean fill placed over the engineering cap allowed the Neville Land Company to redevelop the site without disturbing the cap and also get way above the floodplain. Long-term protectiveness can be achieved through institutional controls when appropriate, such as obviously prohibiting the groundwater usage where municipal water supplies are provided, as was the case here. Institutional controls ensure further site safety requirements are met and site stewardship standards are established. Since institutional controls were established early in the process, the transfer of ownership from the Neville Land Company to the current owner, Robert Marsh University, went smoothly. It's important to listen to the community and the developer and the landowner about the reuse goals and then work with those interested parties to identify remedial design alternatives that work cooperatively with reuse plans and remediation goals. This is just one example of how reuse can harmoniously coexist alongside a cleanup that involves a cap. Early reuse considerations at the site and careful consideration of the capping structure help prepare the site to become a recreational asset to the community. And that's all I have. If anybody has any question, there's one slide. There's the site today. You see the dome, the indoor track, and the signage listing everything that's there. It's a very successful reuse, and we're very proud of that. So if there's any questions, Jean.
Thank you, Chris. That's great. You know, in the interest of time, we're going to push along, and I'm going to let Fran go next. But all my viewers, I need you to hang around because we'll have questions at the end. So, Fran, I'm going to let you go ahead. Thank you, Chris.
Thanks, Chris, and thanks, Melissa. My name is Fran Costanzi, and I'm a remedial project manager as well as the Superfund redevelopment coordinator in Region 8. Region 8 covers six states, Colorado, Utah, Wyoming, Montana, North and South Dakota, with the regional office located in Denver, Colorado. I'm going to talk about one of our smaller sites where yet reuse was very successful, the Rose Park Sludge Pit Superfund site in Salt Lake City, Utah. We'll see how Salt Lake City and the potentially responsible party worked with EPA and the Utah Department of Environmental Quality to address concerns and facilitate discussions about reuse that would lead to public recreational spaces on the remediated site. First, let's take a look at some of the site cleanup history so as to understand where the site was when reuse considerations began. After that, we'll go through the reuse story and talk about where the site is today. So, for site background, the site is actually a very small area, 5 acres, located in Salt Lake City, Utah, in the Rose Park community. You can see it here in this little rectangular box on your screen. It's surrounded by undeveloped land and recreational space, and it was listed way back in 1983. The Utah Oil and Refining Company disposed of acidic waste sludge in an unlined pit on the site from the 1930s until 1957. This waste material was generated from the petroleum refinery that was located just east of the site. In 1957, Salt Lake City purchased the property, which is located in the Rose Park community. In 1960, Salt Lake City Corporation removed 40 to 100 truckloads of sludge and covered the remaining waste sludge with a soil cap. Then, in 1976, a bulldozer, which was working on the expansion of existing recreational facilities at the surrounding Rosewood Park, broke through the soil covering the sludge and exposed the acid sludge waste. Refinery sludges contain polycyclic aromatic hydrocarbons, PAHs, and sulfur dioxide. The community voiced concerns about the physical contact with the sludge, the release of acidic vapors from the site, and to a lesser extent, the groundwater contamination. EPA and the potentially responsible party, which was Amoco, and it's now owned by British Petroleum, BP, conducted a number of site investigations between 1979 and 1981, which, as most of you know, is around when the Superfund law was being passed. The sludge pit covered an area of approximately 5 acres, and the waste materials were found as deep as 20 feet below the ground surface. At the request of the state of Utah, EPA listed the site on the National Priorities List in September 1983. In 1982, Salt Lake City Corporation, Salt Lake City County Health Department, the Utah Department of Health, EPA, and Amoco signed an intergovernmental corporate cooperative agreement, ICCA, regarding the site cleanup. The ICCA required Amoco to conduct the site cleanup, and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers oversaw the remedy construction. The primary objective of the selected remedy was to prevent exposure to the acid sludge waste, eliminate potentially unhealthy odors and vapors, prevent off-site migration of the sludge through surface water and groundwater. The remedy consisted of installing additional monitoring wells, constructing a bentonite slurry wall around the pit, and capping the pit with a sand layer, fabric membrane, clay layer, and a vegetated soil cover. Institutional controls, a traffic barrier, and signs identifying the containment structure were also required. The ICCA included a groundwater monitoring plan to ensure that the continued protection of groundwater and to monitor for possible releases of contaminants from the sludge pit. A fund for groundwater monitoring was established by Amoco and Salt Lake City to provide for 30 years of sampling and monitoring. Amoco completed all the required remedial actions of the ICCA in April 1984. In September 1985, EPA Region A prepared a site deletion package in cooperation with headquarters in the state and conducted public relations activities as a part of the MPL deletion. A site closeout was not required under Superfund at that time, but with the impending passage of the Superfund reauthorization, SARA, in 1986, deletion of the site was delayed until June of 2003. So for moving on to reuse considerations, residents in the Rose Park neighborhood frequently use the Rosewood Park that exists frequently for purposes such as soccer, volleyball, baseball, tennis, and more recently a skate park, and also for picnics. The City of Salt Lake recognized that the site's convenient location within the existing park and thought that it, too, could become an amenity for the area. And, frankly, the Rose Park community needed additional recreational areas. The city identified that adding a dog park and additional parking spaces on the capped area of the site were ways that could actually improve Rosewood Park and help expand it. However, the property had been vacant for years, and combined with its history of contamination, local community members still viewed the area as a blighted property, even though it had been cleaned up. Sites posted on the site fence may have also had an unnecessary alarming effect. Though they were meant to help protect the site, the strong warnings of contamination and risk perpetuated the site's reputation as a health hazard and a burden to the community. Your screen shows pictures of vandalism that was noted back in 2007 during the five-year review. Since the community saw the property as contaminated and useless, trespassing and vandalisms were ongoing problems. The five-year review in 2007 noted several instances of vandalism at the site, including vandalism of the monitoring wells. Also, the vegetated cover over the cap was not in good condition. As you just saw, the institutional and engineering controls, which included the fence, were not only creating an air of uneasiness, but they also prevented motor vehicles from entering the capped area, which meant that the city's proposal to add parking spaces on the site might not be feasible. Any type of site reuse would require the balancing of the priorities of multiple stakeholders without compromising the protectiveness of the site's remedy during all reuse stages, including design and construction. So EPA and the Utah Department of Environmental Quality work closely with all the site stakeholders, including the City of Salt Lake and BP, to address concerns and facilitate discussions about reuse. It should be noted that all the parties were eager to see this property reused. The reuse of an underutilized and formerly contaminated property can often lead to long-term stewardship of the remediated site and decrease instances of vandalism if community members view the area as beneficial and usable space. Ultimately, the parties decided that a lightweight parking area on the site would be protective of the remedy, and the institution controls could be adjusted to allow for recreational uses. And your screen shows a picture of that lightweight parking area. The parking lot design included a geogrid support system under the paving so the parking lot could be constructed over the southern portion of the capped area and not compromise the cap integrity. The City of Salt Lake completed construction of this lightweight parking area. The new parking spaces increased site visibility by bringing visitors to the sitescape. This was helpful in reducing vandalism because it essentially created extra surveillance of the site by inviting park visitors to the site area and making the site area more visible to park visitors. The previous parking area prior to this being built had been located on the other side of Rosewood Park. In addition to the new parked area, the City of Salt Lake hopes to build a dog park over part of the capped area. As with the parking lot, the city was proactive about communicating with Utah Department of Environmental Quality and EPA about plans to put a dog park at the site. Both UDEQ and EPA accepted the city's dog park plans in July 2007. The city used existing areas of the property with fencing and low barrier walls to accommodate a dog park, which would be the first in the area where dogs could play unleashed. The now well-established vegetative cover and use of existing fencing allow for an easy, low-budget transition to a dog park. While the area is currently being informally used, it has not been officially opened yet as a city dog park. As it currently exists, it's accessible to dogs and pedestrians, but prohibits motor vehicles from accessing the capped area. The city has also converted a property adjacent to the west side of the site into a new skate park and installed new playground and exercise equipment, sidewalks, and landscaping. So here's some pictures, more pictures of the site area today. On the top you can see ball fields, and below there's a view of the skate park. Key lessons is that, as you can see, it's never too late for reuse, even the site that was listed back in the beginning of Superfund. EPA deleted the site, transferred the lead to the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, and the site, with the exception of five-year reviews, could have easily fallen off everyone's radar. We're so glad that it did not, and the city was proactive about seeking assistance and acceptance from both the state and federal agencies to reuse this area. The Rose Park Sludge Pit site is an excellent example of how no site should be considered off-limits or unusable. The key is finding a reuse that works with the site remedy, whether it's working with the original remedial design early in the process or working with a constructed remedy such as a cap as it stands at that point in time. As Superfund sites progress through the cleanup pipeline, some reuses may be easier to implement than others at various stages. However, reuse should be the goal for every site and should be considered at any stage in the cleanup. At the Rose Park Sludge Pit site, we learned that though remedial decision documents often require institution controls and engineering controls, the controls that are put in place, particularly on older sites, might become overly strict or even unnecessary as the site cleanup progresses. When considering a certain reuse for a site, it's important that all parties discuss what the current restrictions on the site need to be in order to ensure protection of human health and the environment, and evaluate those restrictions that may have changed over time. This project could have never come about without the Utah Department of Environmental Quality, EPA, and the City of Salt Lake's teamwork. The city was diligent about submitting proposal plans to EPA and UDEQ, not only for the projects they wished to develop on the site itself, but also on neighboring properties. This ensured that all on-site and nearby reuse was safe and appropriate. Contractors for the responsible parties still regularly inspect the site to ensure the cap remains intact, and they also sample groundwater wells, but public perception has changed. Now the site is viewed as an asset to the community instead of an eyesore. City personnel ensure that on-site portions of Rosewood Park, such as the proposed dog park area and the current parking lot, remain safe, and their diligence adds a layer of protection and oversight to agency requirements. As more people care about and benefit from the site property reuse, the more responsible stewards the site will have. The agency has found that, in general, sites that are well-maintained and in active reuse are less likely to have trespassing and vandalism than sites that appear abandoned and ill-kempt. So thanks for your time today. If you have any further questions about the Rose Park Sludge Pit site or about reuse in Region 8, feel free to contact me at the email address or phone number above.
Thanks, Fran. That was great. I want to make sure that we have time for everybody to get through their presentation, so I'm going to have questions till the end, and I'm going to turn it over now to John from Region 2 to talk about the Brick Township landfill.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Very good. Again, my name is John Gorin. I work as a remedial project manager at EPA Region 2, which consists of New York, New Jersey, Virgin Islands, and Puerto Rico. And as you can see from the slide, I'm here to talk about the Brick Township Landfill Superfund site, solar panel field reuse. But since I wrote that slide, I actually think a better title would have been how the Township of Brick turned their 40-acre Superfund site from a revenue drain into a revenue generator. So I understand we have limited time, so I'm just going to give a brief description of the site. I'll discuss the township's dual design goals and in some ways the design engineers met those goals. Then I'll end with a brief discussion on why the township selected a solar field for reuse. Let me see if I get that arrow to work. The Township of Brick is a middle-class town in coastal New Jersey of about 75,000 people, and it includes a small portion of Barrier Beach. Brick Township Landfill, also known as French's Landfill, also known as McCormick's Landfill, began operation in the 1940s as a disposal site for municipal waste. In 1973, the township bought the landfill with the intention of closing it. However, due to state regulations, it required to continue operating until 1979. After operation ceased, the property was covered with 2 feet of clean soil. The property is about 40 acres in size, of which about 27 acres were used for waste disposal. And as you can see from this before photo, which must have been taken sometime before June 2011, till we came in, the landfill was heavily vegetated. And as you can also see, it was surrounded by a residential community. What you can't see is that there is a 470-acre area of contaminated groundwater emanating from the landfill. The state and township have put in place controls to prevent well insulation and prohibit groundwater use, so no one's using that groundwater. And I'm sure many of you are acquainted with this sort of figure, and similar to what's represented in this cartoon, the landfill waste lies above the water table. Rain trickles through the soil cover, which isn't represented here, then into the waste, through the underlying soil, and finally into the aquifer, which transported roughly eastward through in the groundwater. As I mentioned before, in 1973, Brick bought and then operated the landfill. They were the only viable operator found, and therefore they became the sole potentially responsible party, or what we call a PRP. So their contractors performed all the investigations and the cleanups, but under New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection and JDEP and US EPA oversight. In 2008, EPA selected the sole and final remedy for the site through what we call a Record of Decision, or a ROD. And the decision was threefold: placement of what we call institution controls, such as the groundwater restrictions I mentioned or the stuff that Dan was speaking about, installation of an impermeable cap to prevent rainwater from infiltrating through the waste, and also long-term monitoring of the groundwater. We expect the groundwater contamination will begin to naturally attenuate once we get the cap in place to interrupt the source area. So the township really had two objectives. They were legally obligated to design and install the cap and other components of EPA's Record of Decision, but they also wanted to reuse the property, especially as it had been such a financial drain to the community. Tara Paxson, who's the town's assistant planner, and Scott Pizarro, the town's business administrator, looked at several different options for reuse, and they eventually advised the town board that the best use for a cap property would be a photovoltaic solar field. And the board agreed. So why solar? At the end of this talk, I'll touch on some reasons they selected solar and why it was considered the best option. But before I get to that, I want to talk a little bit about the design. Ari Kremen, who now works for Cornerstone Environmental, was the township's design consultant. He already knew his task was to design the cap to meet EPA's requirements. Now he's also asked to consider its final use as a solar farm. So his team looked at the requirements. Obviously, EPA and the state wouldn't allow them to penetrate or compromise the cap in any way. At the same time, Dr. Kremen's clients, Brick Township, wanted to fit in as many panels as possible on the property while also minimizing the amount of any additional maintenance. The township also wanted to make sure the sight line from adjacent homes was aesthetically pleasing as possible. The design team came up with some ideas. They determined that frame-mounted solar panels on ballasted skids was the best option for protecting the impermeable layer. They decided to make the sides of the capped areas relatively steep. I think it was about a 2-to-1 ratio. Obviously, the steeper the sides, the larger the plateau areas, meaning they can squeeze in more panels. The landscape designer came up with a way to break up the grassy slopes to make them a bit more visually appealing. And the team decided to use bluestone rather than soil vegetation as a cap's top layer. Bluestone is better for placing the skids and, importantly, also requires less maintenance since it prevents the growth of grass and weeds. And one thing about the bluestone, which we found out, if you look right here, you can see some bird eggs camouflaged among the stones. Apparently, killdeer, which is a type of migratory bird, likes to lay eggs in stony fields, and which, since they're protected, can impact a work schedule. So if you're using bluestone and you're in the Northeast, you might want to consider scheduling during non-nesting times. All right, so obviously for this remedy to work, the key component is a well-designed cap. At minimum, the cap must prevent waste migration, allow rainwater drainage, and accommodate settling. The diagram on the left shows the general cap requirements in New Jersey. Briefly, the area of waste is leveled off with fill material, and New Jersey allows the use of approved non-virgin fill, so you don't have to use clean soil, which I think is a good thing, on top of which is placed the impermeable layer, which generally is high-density polyethylene, or HDPE, then a bedding layer, sand drainage layer, and it's finally covered with topsoil and planted with grass. The brick cap is a bit different. As I mentioned, rather than topsoil and grass, it is covered with 6 inches of bluestone over about a foot of clean sand. And rather than HDPE, the designer selected a geosynthetic clay layer, which is easy to install, especially on steep slopes. And our model showed that the modified cap they designed would exceed the impermeability required by federal and state standards by an order of magnitude and also exceed the impermeability of the New Jersey reference cap. So this figure shows the cap and solar field's final design. You can see, let me get this going to move again. You can see the three main plateau areas. This is the highest. These are the lower two. And the ground level areas, and they're all covered. All that blue area is covered with solar panels. The drainage area is fairly typical. You have sheet water runs down, goes into this swale, and then into the infiltration basin. Rainwater is also collected in several underground conduits where it flows along a trench and again into the infiltration basin. Once in the basin, the rainwater should drain within like 72 hours. And then this photo looks like they're getting ready to lay down the bluestone. But I included this picture so you can get a sense of how close the slopes are to, you know, the homes. Remember, before we came in to make things better, the adjoining homes were looking at a wooded area. Sure, it was an uncapped Superfund site causing all kinds of problems, but, you know, it looked pretty nice. So the town was very determined to make the final cap as pleasing as possible. And I think they came up with some good ideas. Again, these homes are staring at 20 to 30-foot high slopes, very steep slopes. In general, what you do is just cover those slopes with grass. But the township came up with another idea where they would put in benches midway up, and the benches would have a little deeper soil over the impermeable layer to allow them to plant shallow-rooted trees and shrubs, giving a somewhat more pleasing view to the nearby homeowners. And I haven't heard anybody complain yet, so I'm guessing it worked. This photograph is in the early part of the landscaping, and the bench area was right about here, and these are where the shrubs and trees would go. And this picture also gives you an idea how steep the slope is. Cap was effectively completed in 2013, and at the end of this rainbow, we find not gold, but something better, solar panels. And the design allowed the solar developer to install over 24,230 watt panels. which are expected to produce 7,400 megawatt hours of electricity a year. And this all goes online next week. So I showed you the before June 2011 photo. Here's the after photo taken sometime in September, October 2013. As you can see, nearly every flat layer is covered with solar panels, including a layer that we hadn't originally intended to use. And the only area that's not covered is the infiltration basin for obvious reasons. So now back to the question I asked before, you know, why solar? Well, there's actually a lot of reasons. BRIC is a low-lying coastal community, so they're keenly aware of risks from climate change. So a renewable project is kind of like a do-what-we-can effort to at least lower their carbon footprint. As we saw, the landfill is surrounded by residences, so solar panel generation is quiet and doesn't require a lot of traffic or noisy maintenance. The township probably figured that the regulators, I mean EPA and DEP, would be very happy with this reuse, and they're correct about that. So all these are reasons, and there were other ones that they were considered, but the main reason was solar panel generation can provide a good amount of revenue. And the reason for that isn't simply tax breaks, grants, or even the sale of electricity. The main source of revenue is due to New Jersey's renewable portfolio standards, or an RPS. An RPS is simply a requirement that an electricity generator produce a certain percentage of their power from renewable sources. If they fail to do that, they have to pay a fee to the state. Some states, such as in New Jersey, not only require a certain percentage to come from renewable sources, but a certain percentage needs to be specifically from solar power, hence the term the solar carve-out. So a non-renewable electricity generator provider in a state with an RPS legislation has three choices. They can begin producing enough renewable energy to meet the RPS requirements, they can pay that yearly fee, or they can purchase credits from renewable energy generators, and most choose the last one. Those credits are called renewable energy certificates, or RECs, and the ones for solar are called SRECs. In New Jersey, one SREC is earned for every annual megawatt hour of solar energy produced. So BRIC Landfill, for example, is expected to produce 7,400 megawatt hours a year, so therefore earn 7,400 SRECs per year. A non-renewable power generator can then buy SRECs directly from the solar producer through a contract, or they can be bought and sold on a spot market, sort of like pork bellies or cocoa or other commodities. But since they're being sold on a market, the price will fluctuate, and sometimes by a lot. As you can see by this graph, in June 2011, the price for an SREC in New Jersey was over $500. By August of the same year, it bottomed out to $175. And since then, it's been fluctuating around $200. But even at that bottom price, that $175 price, SRECs would still provide the majority of this project's total revenue. So bottom line, without SRECs, there wouldn't be enough revenue from this project to make it financially sound. So recognizing the risk in the SREC market, and also recognizing that there were tax credits a municipality would not be eligible for, the township decided to do what many landowners do and partner with an experienced private solar developer, in this case, Standard Alternative. The township was able to provide the developer low-rate financing, and the township and the developer is responsible for paying back these loans, and yes, there is a guarantor, so it virtually removes risk to the local taxpayers, which obviously is very important. And the town then profits through leasing the property to the developer and receiving discount electricity for 15 years. Why 15 years? Because that's the maximum amount of years a solar project can earn SRECs. After 15 years, the township then assumes ownership of the solar field and all the electricity it produces. The developer, for their part, benefits through cheaper financing, acquiring the tax benefits, and also selling, you know, revenue through electricity and mostly SREC sales for 15 years. So in summary, by installing this cap, the township met the requirements of EPA's record of decision. The cap should allow natural restoration of the township's impacted groundwater, which is good. The township formed a partnership to reuse a brownfield in a way that's both environmentally and financially sound. And the township expects to eventually recoup some, if maybe all, of the money they spent on the cleanup through revenue and savings from the solar farm. And if anybody wants to contact me to discuss this further, I can get into a lot more details. I also put in some links I thought might be useful. There's the BRIC Township site link, which gives the record of decision, and more importantly for many of you, the design documents that you may be interested in. I put in a site about EPA's webpage. Okay, someone sent me a message. So I put a site about EPA's webpage on citing renewable energy in contaminated areas. This is a very useful webpage, a ton of information. If you're even thinking about this, I would say this is the best place to start. Put in some information on New Jersey SRECs program. Every state program. You know, the states that do have RPS or SREC, every state is variable. So I would, if you're not New Jersey, I would just focus on what your own state is doing. And then finally, there's a link to a video produced by Brick Township about this project, which I thought was interesting. So ready for questions.
Thank you, John. That's great. And we do have a lot of questions. So what I'd like to do is pause for a minute, and we're going to try to get them answered. I'm going to do this sort of my own way of doing this, but I need you, John, right now for the first question.
Okay.
And the question is, what is the cost of the Bluestone cap, and what is the cost of a more conventional soil cap?
Well, I don't know. You know, this is a PRP site, so I usually don't get into the details of what a cap costs. I do know that they were predicting they were going to cost for the whole cap. I mean, the whole thing, not just doing the cap, but you know, they had to expand their street and all the work they were planning on doing when they had it before they redesigned the cap was about 11. Came out to about 10.5 million total. So I think the costs are comparable, but you know, I guess it depends on how much soil is going for on the market and how much bluestone is going on the market, because they use a lot of both in either cap.
Okay, great. Thanks. Let's see. Who's our next question?
The next one is for Fran.
Okay. Fran, what I want to ask you is someone is asking, where synthetic materials are used in the multi-layer – oh, actually, that was Ohio River Park. Okay. All right. Chris, this one is for you. So where synthetic materials – are used in the multi-layer cap, were synthetic materials used in the multi-layer cap at Ohio River Park? And if so, how is the longevity of these materials considered in regards to the length of time that the contamination will remain?
That's a good question. I'll have to find that out for you. I'm not actually RPM for this site, but I can find that out.
Okay.
What the actual material is.
Yeah, that sounds fine. I want to just take a moment and say I very much appreciate all our presenters, and I especially appreciate the presenters who presented on sites that were not theirs. So we'll get back to you and with that question. Thanks, Chris. Why don't we take what's our next question? Should we take a general question from up here? Okay. This is a question actually for all our presenters. Do reuse CAP Superfund sites require regular monitoring to ensure there is no leakage? So would one of you like to speak about that?
I could start. This is John Gorin.
Right.
Every cap requires that. So just because it doesn't really matter where you use it. If you have a cap, there's going to be requirements to maintain it. I don't know of any cap, at least a Superfund cap, that doesn't have an O&M plan and a maintenance plan. So, and that would go through, that would be part of a deed notice, whatever the state requirements are as an institutional control. So just because we're using it doesn't mean that you don't have to continue to operate and maintain it.
Okay. Anybody want to add anything to that, our presenters?
Yeah, this is Fran. I'd like to add something. That's actually an important consideration. I totally agree with what John said. But in addition, if you have a site that was done under a fund lead where EPA and the state paid for the cleanup, one of the advantages of reuse could very well be that the entity that takes over the reuse ends up paying for it, so that can save operation and maintenance dollars that might have to come out of the state's budget instead. And often, if, for example, it's a parking lot that's been added on top, that would be just normal what a owner would have to do anyhow. So that's one of the advantages of reuse that could come very much in handy.
Thanks, Fran. That's great. Anybody else? Okay. I have a general question now that I'd like to ask our panel. Do these sites remain on the property of the PRP who continues to owe property tax on land that has no value and remains a liability?
I can answer that, too.
Okay, great.
And the answer is, of course, it depends. So one of the things that can happen is the original owner can maintain responsibility and someone else can use it. Also, the land can actually be transferred. And we can work out, we have a whole bunch of tools to help work out agreements with the new property owners so that they are not inheriting past liability, but only inherit, if they would cause a problem in the future that was separate. So The Superfund Redevelopment Initiative has a whole bunch of tools that can help with that, and as well as EPA RPMs and their site attorneys can help out with that. There's another option which happens less frequently, where EPA can purchase the property. Though the law requires that the state take title upon completion of the remedial action. We don't usually go that route. We usually keep it in private hands.
Thanks, Fran. Anybody else want to add anything to that? Okay, great. We've got another general question. Maybe, Fran, you can answer this one, too. Can you bring me back there?
Yeah, I'm going to bring it right up here. So we're pulling it up again. And this one got into penetration on clay caps. You might need to read it off of the screen.
Okay, great. So a clay cap, once it's penetrated by footings for a building worn down by sledding trails or damaged for the construction of water lines, let's say if you put in a drinking fountain at a ball field, may no longer comply with closure regs for the cap, and the cover may then be deteriorated. So does the PRP have to amend the cap at that time? So our distinguished panel, anybody want to try to answer that one?
This is Chris. I'll take a shot at that. Yes, that is a requirement in most cases that the those responsible, whether the PRP or EPA, is the lead on financing the remedial action to maintain it. So I would say yes. And in the instance of Ohio River Park, they put on the extra feet of clean fill to allow for piping and such to be placed in it without disturbing the multi-layer cap that was underneath.
Yeah, I'd like to add, the idea of puncturing a cap is shocking as an RPM. So that's a generally bad idea, and I don't know how often that happens. Hopefully not a lot. But I think that, you know, goes to the best time to decide what your future use is going to be is during at least the early design phase, if not the pre-recorded decision phase. Because that way, for example, we put conduits down, underground conduits on Grick Township landfill. And they don't go under the impermeable layer. They're sitting on top of the impermeable layer, and we kind of put little dents in the impermeable layer so we can run them down the sides. So you should have it designed so you don't have to go through that impermeable layer. And I think it's a bad idea to puncture that for any reason.
This is Fran. I would just add that it can be done. You can puncture caps, but I would totally agree that it has to be done thoughtfully with good oversight and good controls.
Great, thanks. Okay, we've got a nice general one for everybody. What strategies or approaches does each presenter suggest to best address public acceptance and the stigma of Superfund site contamination in order to promote reuse? And was this a problem at any of the case studies that we talked about today? So, Fran, you want to start with that? And then we'll just go down the list.
Sure. Actually, that's something that the Superfund redevelopment coordinators in each region can help with. We have a whole series of not only these webinars, but videos and fact sheets that RPMs and their site teams can use to help reach out and give examples of where successful reuse has occurred and what needs to be thought of during the process. Usually when people start to have a bigger understanding and work through that, it gains greater acceptance.
Great, thanks. Jonathan, you want to add to that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, brick was very tricky for that respect, because a lot of people who bought land right along that property for whatever reason were not told, even though they were supposed to be told, that that wooded area, that nice wooded area adjacent to your backyard where your kid's swing set is a Superfund site. So they were very unhappy to begin with. So it's really kind of a two-part question. One is, why do you have to tear the trees down and put a cap on it? And once we got people confident this is the right thing to do, they were very happy that we're doing it and getting rid of this risk to their groundwater. The second question is about the reuse, and there was a lot of input, and especially to the township, and how this should be reused. And someone once mentioned in one public meeting putting wind power there, and it was like almost a riot, even though no one was seriously considering that. So I guess if you have a lot of people adjacent to it, I would work with them closely to make sure the things they don't want. And generally it's going to be, they don't want a lot of traffic, they don't want a lot of noise, they don't want a lot of dust.
That's great. Chris, do you want to add anything to that?
Sure. The Ohio River Park, I think it was an interesting case because even before EPA was involved with the site, Allegheny County and the landowner had seen what they wanted to do with this. They were putting the park in already. So it's kind of tragic that ended. The park had to be dismantled, but then they still had the vision of making that a park, and through the public relations process, from what research I've been able to do, people were pretty agreeable to that. Plus, EPA got huge brownie points for doing the no-action ride on the 1 acre that allowed the bridge to be built. And I just noticed through the file there's some newspaper reports speaking very favorably of EPA for that. So again, like Fran said, all these sites are different. The owner and the county had a land use plan envisioned before EPA got involved, which allowed this site to be remediated to allow for that future reuse.
Thanks, Chris. Dan, can you hear us?
Sure, I can hear you.
Great. Okay, you want to take a crack at that question? That'd be great.
Yeah, I think at Norwood, anyway, it was a bit of a sticking point because we had a private property owner and certainly a developer working for that property owner or had the rights to develop that property. So it's difficult, and the cap was completed prior to any development plans, and like other sites, the abutters, and I could have pointed out some of the residential abutters, they were just as happy to have several acres of pavement behind their homes versus maybe the lights and the noise that might be associated with a large commercial redevelopment. As it were, as was proposed, there were some environmental concerns about building that large-scale big box store. I think their concerns were jointly about the cap as well as all the other ancillary things that come along with redevelopment of a big box store. And so at the end of the day, a much smaller development was realized, and there's been no complaints. But I guess it's just, I think as a regulator, it's difficult for us to dictate specifically what type of end use should be used to these private properties. I think
okay,
we
thanks.
Left that much more to the community.
Great. Okay, that's a good question. We actually have a Norwood question, so let me ask you that. And someone is saying, did the ICs in the deed run with the land, and are the restrictions enforceable, and by who? And I heard that environmental covenants are more enforceable.
Yeah, the ICs do run with the land, and based on the timing of everything, and somebody else made this point, EPA, the federal government, can't hold property rights after remedial action. And so we actually had the added benefit of the owner transferring his rights, certain rights, and recording the restrictions, and it went straight to the DEP. So actually our state partner here plays a very large role in enforcing the institutional controls, but they run with the land. And was another part of that question? So basically what that means is they are attached to that deed in perpetuity.
Okay, great. And I've got I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, that's okay.
Okay, I've got another Norwood question for you. Somebody's written in, it seems, I don't know if you can answer this question, but maybe our panel might want to weigh in. It seems EPA has become less willing to enter into PPAs. This is probably likely varies by region. The developer was able to obtain a PPA in 1999, but do you think this would happen in 2014? Somebody want to...
Listen,
yeah, why don't we start with Dan, and then we can move down the line. Dan, do you want to give anything to add to that?
I think in 1999, and I was aware of other PPAs also at the same time frame, those all predate the Brownfield legislative changes, which, as I understand it, has been explained to me by our different enforcement attorneys here, that those statutory protections in some of the Brownfield legislation provide much of the same protections that were in PPAs prior to those Brownfield amendments being passed. And so it's really not, doesn't get you anything more than what you already have for protection under the law as it presently is now.
Chris, I think I heard you trying to chime in there.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to what Dan said. He's absolutely right. In 1999, the Brownfields Law had not yet been amended to allow for bona fide prospective purchasers to acquire property and afford them liability protection. The PPA at the time was the only legal remedy available to get that liability protection for prospective purchasers. Now when the law changed, they don't need the PPA. Now there's specific cases where it might be a good idea to do that, specifically when there's a RCRA involvement as well as Superfund. But as Dan says, PPAs aren't really, we don't encourage them in Region 3 now because they're really not necessary in probably 99% of the cases because the liability protection is self-implementing, and that's really the way it is now.
Oh, thanks. Fran, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I think they did a good job of covering it, and, you know, with limited resources, because there's coverage, we don't usually go that route, except, as they both said, in very limited cases.
Great. And Jonathan, you want to add anything to that?
I usually avoid the legal questions, but I think Dan and Chris covered it.
Okay. We're running short on time here, but let me take a question. Is it appropriate to start considering reuse at the remedial investigation stage? So the answer is yes. We are pushing
for
a presumptive remedy at this early stage. The site is an old landfill. So maybe, Fran, you want to start with that just from your perspective of why it's always okay to talk about this early on?
It's more than okay. It's actually important if you can do it. And we highlighted some older sites today where we ended up finding reuse after the fact. But really, you should be looking at reuse early on, for no other reason that it helps inform your risk assessment and also your RFS process. So it can actually help you select what could be a better, more sustainable remedy over time and helps you figure out what your reasonably anticipated future land use is, which, as I said, informs your risk assessment and could help you develop better alternatives for the site.
Thanks. That's great. Dan or John, you want to add anything, or Chris?
Sure. Yeah, I would just be a little wary about the term presumptive remedy because a lot of the times we don't have presumptive remedies. But, you know, without thinking that way, I would absolutely do it. Like, suppose you did have a landfill which you could have presumptive remedy, but it's nice to know, hey, we're probably going to cap this, have an idea what you're going to do, and that might give you the notion of getting more information about the waste in the landfill and how it's going to settle with the cap on it. So there's tons of information you could gain that if you have an idea of what you're going to use in the future use. And I could think of like 3 of the 9 criteria that knowing the future use would be helpful for when you're deciding on your remedy. So absolutely, early have an idea, the better.
Okay, anybody else want to weigh in on that?
I was just going to add, and I don't know if it's a Region 1 thing or national guidance, and if there is guidance, if it's draft, but I seem to recall some acknowledgement of evaluating or at least some giving some consideration to future use, future reuse Superfund sites as early as the RIFF stages. So that if it's not codified or in some sort of guidance document, I think that it likely will be. I don't know if anybody
there
else
is
familiar with.
Yeah, there is guidance. There is guidance, and you can find it on the Superfund redevelopment webpage.
Okay. Any last thoughts on that issue? Okay, I see you all are voting. We've sort of run out of time here. I want to the ways you can get more information, that you can have contacts either at headquarters and our information by coordinators by region. Okay. Should we go on and do another? Okay, all right. We have a few more minutes, so we can try another question, but I hope you guys are voting, so that would be really good. I've got a question for John. Let's see. Okay. Are utility companies the only companies who can purchase SRECs?
No, you mean like on the market? My understanding is anybody can purchase the SREX. But the in fact, I know that they're well, I'm not going to even get, you can get so into this, it's a little inside baseball. No, anybody can purchase SREX. You can go online right now to that market, the state-run market, and purchase SREX. And then hopefully the price will go up, and then you can sell them to someone who needs to retire them at the end of this spot month, which I think is June next year. But no, anybody can purchase SREX, and anybody can sell SREX.
Okay, that's great. We've got a question now back to Dan on Norwood. So let's see, somebody's asking, can you confirm that none of the buildings were built on the capped areas?
Yep. So when the remedy was built, we had very specific as-builts with benchmarks that were surveyed in, and we required those benchmarks to survive redevelopment. And so they're very specific meets and bounds descriptions of the cap and the slab cap and cover areas and the non-cap, non-cover areas. So that was something that was achieved just through, you know, engineered surveys, land surveys.
Okay, and I've got a follow-up question on that. Let's see, was the liquid boot and subslab compelled by a rod change, or is it an IC?
Well, that's a good question. It wasn't a rod change or specified in any rod amendment or ESD. It was basically would be considered part of the ICs to be, you know, conservatively protective of anybody that might you know, your commercial worker scenario, that was the basis for making sure that we had some additional protection. It basically was, it amounted to belt and suspenders and was a very easy thing to include or require in the construction. And the developer, I'm reluctant to say they were happy to do it, but then again, you know, including that was certainly a low-cost mitigation measure that, you know, should we ever have a need for greater protection, we can make that an active system.
Okay, and I've actually got another question also about that site. Somebody's written in, capping of up to 24,000 milligrams/kilograms of PCBs was permitted under TSCA.
Yeah, that would predate my involvement in the site, which goes back to 2001. So I'm not sure how the TSCA questions were handled or what permits were or what permissions were obtained. I know the people and can get back to you on that. The past RPMs are still here.
We can handle that offline. That'd be fine. Sure. Let's see. We've got another one. Okay, this is a general question. So how is uneven settlement at old landfill sites addressed during the redevelopment? And I think we can ask that to everybody. Anybody want to give it a shot?
I think the answer depends. You know, with certain types of uses, for example, if it's going to be a park, it's less important than other types of uses. It may end up, though, being a large design factor, or may even have to modify the type of reuse you want, depending on how drastic the differential settling is.
Okay, thanks, Fran. We have a couple of questions, and I can't tell if they were about Norwood, but I'm going to ask them. Let's see, how are the ICs implemented? I think that was a Norwood question. Yeah, and then there's a question about evapotranspiration. So would evapotranspiration vegetative cover greatly restrict other land use options beside green space?
Yeah, I can only try to address the one that may be related to Norwood and how the ICs were implemented. Was that the question? How were they implemented?
Yes.
Because, you know, we have these draft restrictions that are oftentimes an appendix to a CD or a consent decree, and then at a future date prior to recording, they inevitably get reviewed and modified, and we were able to do that to facilitate what was constructed. But they are actually implemented when the restrictions, the permitted uses, and the restricted activities, when those are recorded at the registry, though that's the new law of the land, if you will, and the property owner now and in the future loses the right to do certain activities. So, I mean, the date that they're recorded is the date they're said to be implemented. And then after going forward, it's really in a kind of a quasi-enforcement role that, as I mentioned, the state, you know, I think most of the states take a lead in ensuring compliance with those restrictions. Certainly we, you know, peer, because it's also a peer PLEED site, we, you know, we get annual reporting from them, and we do five-year reviews because waste is left in place, and so we can verify that there's not homes being built or a daycare where there shouldn't be. But they're, you know, the ICs are very prescriptive and describe what they can and can't do and how to apply for activities that are otherwise restricted. And I can send a link if it helps to the actual grant. It might be interesting for people to see that legal document.
Yeah, if you could send that to Gene Ballant, that would be great.
Sure.
Thanks.
No problem.
Okay, I'm sorry to say that we are just about out of time. I'm going to turn it back over to Gene for some closing remarks. I want to thank everybody for doing such a great job today, and I want to thank all the people who submitted questions. If we didn't get to your question, we will try to get to it offline, and we hope you'll join us for our next webinar, so be on the lookout for that. And Gene, go ahead.
Thank you, Melissa. So I want to send a great thank you to the nearly 170 people who joined us from all over the world for today's webinar. We are participating in webinars like this. There are, as we mentioned, 21 archived webinars that you guys can find on the CLUIN website. And this series of Superfund Redevelopment Initiative webinars will carry on this year with our next one on September 10th, 2014. So if you haven't signed up, please visit the CLUIN website and make sure to sign up for that one. For those of you that are looking for copies of the presentation materials or perhaps contact information to touch base with some of our presenters or organizers, you'll find that stuff available off the seminar homepage. We do have a direct link to something known as the seminar links or resources page as well. You'll find it under related URLs towards the middle right. That website does contain a copy of each of the presentation materials delivered today, as well as links to other resources and sites that were discussed. We will ask each of you to take just a brief moment and fill out our short feedback form online. I do read each and every one of those responses, so I can assure you your voice is not lost. If you fill that form out, we are looking to continuously improve our sessions and greatly appreciate it if you could take a moment to do that. If you share the line with multiple people, each person can actually fill out their own feedback form. You'll see a link that'll pop up once you've submitted it to let the next person hop on. That feedback form link is actually active from today forward, so if you don't have time to fill it out or perhaps are actually listening to the recorded version of today's webinar, you can still follow the link to the feedback form, which is off of the homepage as well as listed under related URLs, and you too can provide feedback based off the recorded version of today's webinar. One of the things I'd encourage you to do when you fill out that feedback form, make sure you check a box that you'll see circled here in red. If you check that box once you submit the feedback form, we'll send you an automated confirmation that at least verifies you submitted feedback after the live delivery. So for those of you that are looking to verify or get certificates for your participation today for CEUs or PDHs, may find that using that confirmation email will be helpful in documenting your attendance today. Again, I want to thank the presenters we had join us from various regions today, as well as Melissa for co-hosting today's session. And again, that 170 international participant audience we had, you guys did a great job joining us, and I hope we'll see you or hear from you on the next SRI webinar coming up in September. This will be the formal conclusion for today's live broadcast.